With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, hi. Welcome to Nature Biotechnology's First Rounders podcast. My name is Brady Huggett. I'm the host of this show. Welcome aboard. And the guest today is Tilman Gerngross. He's the CEO of Adimab, where he was a co-founder. He was also co-founder of GlycoFi many years ago and many other companies, including Adagio, which is one of his most recent. He's a co-founder there. We talked about that on this show. He's also a professor of engineering at Dartmouth. So what did we discuss? We discussed his concept of an academic as truth finder. We discussed the offer that triggered competing bids for his company GlycoFi years ago. And we talked about what happened between Adimab and the MIT researcher Ram Sessasekaran last year. Let's pick the conversation up here, where he and I were just talking about Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier winning the Nobel Prize. I think that's all you need. So here it is, your First Rounders podcast with Tilman Gerngross. Listen up.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
You know, the other thing is, I've because I was, you know, doing my research, I always identify you with Adimab. I think that's because the first time I really sat down to talk with you, you were CEO of Adimab, but I'd forgotten all about GlycoFi, really.
Yeah. Well, that's when I knew Laura. I knew Laura from GlycoFi. Those were the early glycoengineering days. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll get to that. But so, you know, the first thing, I kind of want to know how you first understood that you were going to pursue a life of science, or thought that maybe you might want to pursue a life of science.
I think it had much to do with the family I grew up in. My father was an architect. My mother was an interior decorator, a designer, and a sculpturist. And so it was sort of an artsy kind of scene. And while I appreciate that, and I still do to this day, it's a world where opinions matter way more than facts. You know, it's like, this is an important piece of art. This is a a derivative, and this is like not so important, this is kitsch, and this is real art. These are all opinions, right? And I found it very hard to navigate that world because there was nothing like tangible. You know, like one day was this, the next day was that, and I just didn't like that. And so I think people look for stability, and some people find that in religion. That wasn't my thing, and I certainly found stability in sort of in science, where you could ask very concrete questions, and if you're smart enough, you can devise experiments to answer those questions, and that gives you at least, an answer that you can rely on. And
yeah,
you come back a year later, and it's still the same answer, and other people can reproduce it, and it's still the same answer. And so, that world to me was just extremely appealing, and so I think that's what led me down that path.
Yeah, the idea in art sometimes where things go in and out of favor. It's great 1 year, and 10 years later they've decided no, and that turned you off.
Exactly. That totally turned me off, yes.
But if your dad being an architect, that's kind of a mix of science and art a little bit, right? I mean, there's engineering in there.
There is. But again, amongst the architects, they're the ones that are more on the engineering side, and they're the ones that are way out on the artsy side. And my father is way out on the artsy side.
Oh, I see. I see. So where did you grow up?
We grew up really all over the world. So I was born in Austria, in southern Austria on the border to Italy. And my grandfather was the village doctor in this village in the Austrian Alps. And then when I was 4 or 5 years old, we moved to the States. My father went to UCLA. And so
to teach.
No, he was a student. He was a student of architecture there. And so that's when the family moved to LA, and I went to elementary school there. And then we moved back to Germany and then back to Austria. And so I would say in elementary school, I probably went to like 6 or 7 different schools. We just moved
the
time. Yeah.
What is that? I mean, the stereotype is that makes you, that you make friends easily. Is that true? Did that feel true to you? Like you're forced to be able to make friends easily and approach people. I don't know.
I think that's a common response that people have to that sort of story. And I think there's some truth to that, but also it makes you less impressionable to local customs or local vernaculars or local, cultural norms, because you have sort of a different, I think a more broad picture perhaps. And so I think for me, it had both effects. I mean, I get along with most people, but I think it also helps you sort of form your identity perhaps a little bit earlier.
Yeah. And then you just keep that identity no matter where you go.
Exactly. Yeah.
And sometimes that identity becomes like the family, right? You have your brother. I don't know. Do you have brothers and sisters?
I do have a sister. Yeah. She lives in Jamaica. And then I have a whole bunch of half siblings.
Okay. So sometimes that family unit gets real strong if you're moving around like that, and that becomes your core identity.
Well, in our case, it was complicated because my parents got divorced when we were 12. And then we started, my mother moved in a different town and we lived with my mother. And so in our case, that was not, I think, the net outcome. The net outcome was more that I became extremely independent very early on. So I remember like 16, 17, where other kids were like getting involved in stuff that got them into trouble. I had plenty of that. But for example, I was really interested in gardening of all things, and I had this huge vegetable garden. And what I loved about it is you sort of put the effort in, and over the course of a season, you get all these wonderful vegetables back, right? And I liked cooking. And so I just had a very different interest than many other people, but I had lots of friends that enjoyed being part of that. And so it all ended up well.
This grandfather of yours that was a physician, did that have anything to do with you turning towards science too? Maybe the idea of medicine or healing?
No, I don't think so. I mean, he was a role model in some ways, but I don't think he was influential in that regard.
Yeah. Okay. So you're kind of like shying away from the artsy side of your parents, more towards science. And how does that, what does that look like? Were you a standout in science in high school? What were you thinking about undergrad?
Yeah, I did. I mean, the system there is a little bit different, right? So you go through gymnasium, which is the equivalent of high school here. And at that time, I was already very interested in science, and sort of that was, chemistry, biology, physics, math were the things I excelled in. And then you at that point decide what you want to major in when you go to university. So it's not that you sort of do undergrad. It's changed the system since. But when I was there, you decided what you wanted to do. And I was interested in chemical engineering. So that was my thing. And so I started studying chemical engineering. actually, first I went to Paris for half a year because in high school I also studied French. And so I wanted to improve my French, but ended up hanging out mostly with Americans in Paris and never really got fluent. Had a good time, but but then came back to Austria, started studying chemical engineering, got my master's in 89. And then in 89, I applied for a fellowship to go to MIT basically as a visiting scientist to do my PhD thesis. Oh. For the Austrian university. So and so I ended up in a guy named Arnie Demain's lab at MIT, and that's where I did the work that constituted my PhD thesis in Austria.
So when you'd spent that, I don't know how long, in LA, a few years?
3 years, yeah.
3 years. You came back speaking English then.
Yeah, exactly. So actually, I barely spoke. My German was pretty poor because as a kid, you pick it up really fast, yeah. But you also lose it quickly. So yes. Yeah. So yeah, I was fluent in English.
You came back, picked up the German again, I'm assuming.
Yep.
Yeah. Went to do some French. That didn't pan out. But again, you're probably using your English with all those Americans. So that set you up to go to MIT, no problem, obviously, right?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, the Technical University of Vienna was not a particularly like well-known school or like a feeder school that, you know, would sort of set you up to go to MIT. But I knew this professor, Arnie Demain, who was very active in this field that I was doing my thesis on, and so that's the connection that then led to me coming to MIT, and that really changed my life in many ways.
Yeah. So is that common where, you know, you sort of said, look, I want to go study someplace else to get my dissertation finished.
Yeah. I mean, I always joke, it depends on what you do. If you're an opera singer, living in Vienna is a great place, right? If you're a biotechnologist, living in Vienna is not a great place. So it depends on what you want to do. And for me, sort of the Taj Mahal of biotechnology activity was, in my opinion, MIT at the time. And so that's where I wanted to go.
Okay, great. So then, you know, you just said that changed your life. How did that change your life?
It's just the way science was approached, the amount of responsibility you were given. And, you know, here's the problem we're trying to ask. Here's the problem we're trying to understand, or here's the question we're trying to ask. Go figure it out. And giving you that freedom to figure it out just unleashed a level of effort and creativity and just the joy I got doing the work. I just really loved it. And sort of that got me really hooked on doing the kind of stuff I still do to this day.
Which is investigational science, right?
Exactly. Yeah, we'll get into the transition a little bit later and sort of like how there's really two worlds in science, right? There are the basic discovery scientists whose job it is to figure out how things work in the world. You know, we just talked about a Nobel Prize. I mean, figuring out how this gene editing works, right? That is, we didn't know that before. Now it's a powerful tool and there are companies that came from that. But the original impetus was, let's understand how the world works. And that's sort of basic science. As a bioengineer, I see the world somewhat differently. I mean, my job is more to understand where's the science, what is possible with the current understanding of science, and then figure out how do you connect that knowledge to things that matter to humanity. In other words, how do you connect the knowledge with solving a problem that matters? And so that's what I think we did a piece, I don't know how many years ago. You remember that piece you and I had worked on, it's the problem, stupid?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Right. Right, exactly. Like you have to figure out your problem in order that has to be the first thing you do.
And so that is ultimately, I think, where I settled and what I've been doing for the last 20 years or so. I ended up graduating in Austria with this work that I did in Arnie Demain's lab and already had a postdoc offer at MIT. So I just went back, graduated, took the next plane, came back to Cambridge and started my postdoc with a guy named Tony Sinski and a professor in the chemistry department named Joanne Stubbe, and completely changed fields and started doing something new. And that's what I always was interested in, something new. And so I did that for 2 years. And then that faculty member and a bunch of people that were in the lab long before me started a company. And I joined that company and was with that company for 5 years. And that was kind of misery.
It's
a company called Metabolics. I learned a lot of how not to run a company. So I was there for 5 years. And then in 98, I left that company and joined the faculty at Dartmouth.
Okay. So they formed the company and asked you to be in it. And you saw that from the ground up, meaning the way it was formed, whatever IP they had, where they got their funding, et cetera. You were part of all that.
I was the first employee, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. So did that sort of cue you into how to start a company? Even whether you were learning the negative things, you know, you said you saw some things you didn't like, but, you know, you were in at the ground floor.
I think that may have helped. It's hard to tie the two together. Yes, I mean, I'm sure I learned a few things, yes. But I don't think it provided a sort of a blueprint of how to do this later on.
Okay. So when you left it, I mean, you wrote a paper. And so we should talk about what Metabolics is, right? Metabolics is...
Yeah, so the story was that it was an interesting story because there's a theme that we may actually get into a little bit deeper, which is, in my view, society is predisposed to receive certain information. And when they receive that information and it's confirmatory of their own views, they just like eat it up. Like, for example, one view is plastics are bad and we need to replace them, right? Nobody will dispute that with you.
Yeah.
Nobody has any facts, really. And in fact, in my opinion, it's the exact opposite, and we can get into that later. But that's just it's what the public thinks. And when you feed them what they think, they'll like it. Or like now, like, you know, we're going to do a drug discovery with artificial intelligence. Everyone eats that up. There's no evidence that it has really done anything profound, but, you know, people will eat it up all day long.
Yeah.
So this particular area was around making biomaterials, bioplastics from renewable resources. Again, bread and butter issues. Who's going to argue it's a renewable resource, it's biodegradable, and it's made by a living system? Well, isn't that's just green all around?
Yeah.
What nobody factored in is when you actually account for the material streams into the process that include fertilizers and all the stuff that needs to happen to make the raw materials, you end up actually using more energy and you're emitting more greenhouse gases than when you just make polyethylene from natural gas and oil. So in other words, the net impact on the environment is worse if you do this quote unquote green process. And I started to appreciate that because I was running the process development group there. I realized how much cooling these reactors needed. I realized how much agitation and how much oxygenation they require. And that's, you know, in a small scale, it's a little compressor. At 100,000 liter scale, that's, you know, huge energy consumption. And I think I was the first one to sort of ask the question, well, if this is so green, let's just quantify the inputs and outputs. And that analysis led me to the conclusion that, yes, if you want to use up a third of the U.S. agricultural land, if you want to emit more greenhouse gas emissions, if you want to eutrophy the water and, you know, have nitrogen and phosphate emissions to the water increase, if you want all that, this is a great technology. If you want to do something good for the environment, it's probably not a great technology. And so that was a rough awakening. But this goes back to this topic that you brought up earlier, which is I want to do something useful. And so this was a hard lesson because I spent 5 years in industry and then maybe a year at Dartmouth figuring this out. So 6 years of my life I spent on something that retrospectively I say was more or less a complete waste of time.
Yeah. But yes, all the things that you just said, agree with. But isn't the idea, right, is that eventually, once you have these few flagship companies that learn how to make bioplastics, eventually the costs come down, they get more energy efficient, the carbon footprint lowers, and eventually you make bioplastics that are easier and better on the environment? Or you're saying it's never going to be possible?
Well, my analysis wasn't actually looking at the real world energy consumption. It was just saying if this is 100% thermodynamically efficient. So I was already assuming all the improvements that are possible. And even under those scenarios, you just could not get there. You just could not get there. And the other thing is, again, people think that biodegradability is such a wonderful thing. But let me tell you what actually is going on in the world right now. The world is collectively, other than, of course, the United States, is trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and trying to reduce that. So if I give you two plastic materials, one that you throw into a landfill that is inert and doesn't do anything, and the other one actually degrades into methane, that's a bad thing. That's not a good thing. So this whole notion of biodegradability feeds into a human behavioral problem, which is like we just throw shit away and then we want it to disappear. But we have to pay for that convenience in the form of greenhouse gas emissions. So you choose your poison. I'm saying, or I have the position that biodegradability per se is not a good thing, actually, because it leads to greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah. But okay, so I'm walking around saying things like, well, bioplastics are going to be the thing we're going to use one day. We're not going to use petroleum based products anymore. And that's going to be a positive. And you're basically telling me that I'm just spouting the idiocy things that make me feel better.
If you twisted my arm, I would say yes. I don't think you're right, Brady. I don't think you're right. I think this is a bullshit story that's been sold to the public for many years, and because it feels intuitive. Look, you have to listen to someone who spent 6 years of their life trying to promote this stuff and figure it out. I mean, I really know all the details of how this process works, what the shortcomings are, and what I'm telling you is, no, you're not right. You're wrong. Everyone wants to believe it. Again, if you sell them, here's something that is, biodegradable, made from a renewable resource and made by living, sold. Everyone is like, love it. I want that.
Yeah, right? No, I did. I totally agree. Listen,
what I hate to tell you is polyethylene is an incredibly, is an amazing material. Just its physical properties. And actually the relatively low environmental impact to make it.
Yeah.
And then when you throw it away, it's just fossil carbon that we extracted, we then used, and then we put back into the ground where it is inert. It's not leaking anything out. It's just like sitting there doing nothing. So anyway, it's a longer discussion, but.
I love this idea that, it's true because this applies to everything in our world right now, especially politics, that you believe the things that you want to believe because it makes you feel good and it sort of scratches you where you itch. I get that. And I do want to believe the person who spent 6 years of their life studying this and says it's actually not going to work the way we all want it to believe it's going to work. So, yeah, I mean, absolutely tell me those things.
My view is it is not going to provide an environmental benefit. If you want to stimulate employment in rural areas of America, it's a good thing because there's going to be more farming activity. But with that, you're using agricultural land to make plastic that you're now taking away from the food supply. So again, these are always way more complex, these issues, and people reduce it to sort of the few sound bites.
Yeah.
But that's not how the world typically works.
I mean, that's the same thing with corn and ethanol, bioethanol, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, okay, so 5 years at Metabolics and then a year at Dartmouth sort of putting the paper together, and you published a paper saying, look,
I published a paper in Nature Biotech, and then I did another piece with a friend of mine in Scientific American, sort of like explaining the whole thing to the sort of scientifically minded general audience.
Yeah. And was there, you still had friends, I'm assuming, at Metabolics. How did that go over?
Not so well. I would say even at Dartmouth, I mean, the people that sort of hired me into their group that were hoping that I would be involved in research promoting the conversion of biomass into fuels and useful materials. I mean, that was not the outcome that they had hoped for, but there was no choice for me. I mean, this is the conclusion I came to. And I think at the end of the day, as an academic, you're paid to be a truth finder. And then you publish the work and then you have to live by whether it's meritorious or not. Nobody's ever debunked any of this, by the way. They may not like it. And they'll complain about it, but nobody is like he's wrong because of this, this, and this.
Yeah, nobody. I mean, there's still a fairly robust bioplastics industry out there trying to tackle this problem. But you moved away. After that, you went to Glycophy, or you formed Glycophy.
After that, my mindset was, I can't spend another 6 years on something that I then figure out is useless. If I want to solve a problem, it has to be a problem that I think. Develop conviction around that it's an important problem. That means if you solve it, someone's going to really care. If you solve it, you give the impression of solving an important problem. And so I think that six-year lesson, sounds like a heavy price to pay, but it really reinforced in me the notion that if you are going to pick a problem, make sure that you if you solve that problem, there's a meaningful change. It has real impact, and so that I think idea became very clear to me in that sort of 99-2000 time frame.
So let's talk about Glycophy. Tell me how you set it up. Yeah.
So the way that came about was, you remember, it was sequencing of the human genome. People were interested in obviously in drug discovery, and the world was saying, gee, now that we have a blueprint of every single human protein, all these miracle biotech drugs, whether it's insulin, whether it's erythropoietin, and all these recombinant proteins that we've been discovering and that have had material impact on human health, that's going to be all a lot easier and much faster. And I'm like, that sounds like a reasonable assumption. But if that's true, how do people make these proteins? And at the time, mammalian cell culture was still in its infancy. It was still a process that often had low yields, required animal-derived substitutes that, again, at the time were a big issue. Remember mad cow disease and things of that sort. So, so the backbone of that industry was either mammalian cell culture or E. coli. And so if you had a protein that was not post-translationally modified, you could make it an E. coli, but the majority of proteins are actually glycosylated. And so they require a host that recapitulates what goes on in a human cell and therefore glycosylates the protein with human sugars. And so it was clear to me that if you wanted to make an impact there, you would have to come up with a system that allows you to make proteins at low cost, large scale, that have human glycosylation. And I thought Chinese hamster ovary technology was not the answer to that. And again, don't forget, at the time, it was hilarious because people were talking about making recombinant proteins in transgenic goats. In transgenic animals were very popular at the time, right?
Yeah.
Goats, cows, chickens, the entire farm was recruited as a transgenic expression system. A lot of people were making recombinant proteins in plants, corn, tobacco, and things of that sort. As obscure as people were making recombinant proteins in boar semen, right? So it just told you this was a problem that people cared about. There was a lot of people trying to solve it, and I thought a more reasonable solution to that problem would be to use a host system that is well established in the industry, which is yeast and fungal protein expression, which is what the sort of, you know, the commercial industrial enzyme industry uses to make proteins. But why can't you use yeast to make human glycoproteins? The problem is they will put the wrong sugars on the protein and therefore make it useless. And so I like, that's a real engineering problem. Can I take a yeast and basically re-engineer its entire glycosylation machinery to make human glycoproteins? That was the question. And it turned out I wasn't the first one to think about that. In fact, Kirin Brewery had thought about, and no, hadn't just thought about it. They had been working on it for probably 8 years at the time with distinct but marginal success. I mean, and there was a group in Belgium that also had worked on trying to do that in Pichia. And so I knew others were trying. I knew others were partially successful, but I thought one thing I'm good at is cell engineering. And so I think I have a better way of approaching the problem. And I don't think we have time to go into the details, but when you dig into the details, it's super fun to like read their literature, read their papers, really understand what they were doing, and then say, I think that's a mistake. That's not what they should have done. And then you do the experiment and it validates basically your suspicion, and all of a sudden this nut that they've been trying to crack for like 3 years and one frustrating paper after the other, all of a sudden turns out you have the answer to, and you sort of are able to break through that. And then within, I think, 4 or 5 years, we're able to show that we were able to make very discrete human glycoproteins in this engineered yeast that we were working on.
I mean, I remember when Kieran began to get into drug discovery. And I remember thinking, I guess they've got some, they certainly had money, but that makes perfect sense. They're a brewer, right? I mean, they were a brewer by founding. So then they're going to work with yeast. But when you started looking at this problem, did you reach out to them? Did you say, should we collaborate? Or you just read the papers and thought, let's see if I can sort of do it better?
No, we did not reach out to Kieran. However, I mean, again, I really studied their papers, and there was one guy, I forgot his name now, but he was just my hero because this guy had sort of pushed the envelope the furthest. And I remember years later, probably after Glycophy was already acquired by Merck, I met him at a meeting and I was just like, oh my God, you're that guy. And he's like, oh my God, you're that guy, right? And it was just such a funny meeting because I sort of had a huge respect for the guy, but you know, they weren't able to sort of really get it to work. And we ultimately did get it to work. So,
yeah. Okay. So just tell me about like how you founded the company. So you've got this problem, you've identified this problem and you think that you can solve it. So then what did you do?
Yeah. And so this is where Dartmouth is a really unusual sort of academic institution, because while it's really focused on undergraduate teaching, the alumni and sort of the people that are on boards around here are very entrepreneurially minded. And so I was fortunate, I was teaching a class with the former dean of the engineering school, and we would have lunch together, and he asked me what I was doing. And I said, look, I'm working on this problem. I think this is a really important thing. And he said, like, you know, I know two people that are really heavily involved in the biotech industry. I think they should hear your story. So we met with them. They heard it, and they said, it's a super hard problem, but if you solve this, this is going to be something really useful.
Yeah.
And so that ultimately, I think, ended up in Terry McGuire, who's now an old friend, and but he wrote one of the first checks and said, look, I want to give this guy a shot. And it was a small investment, maybe $500,000, and said, let's give this guy a shot and see whether he can do anything with that. And so, and then Dartmouth was very generous in sort of saying, look, we're not going to tax that little money you have. Why don't you give us shares in the company instead, and we'll let you use this lab space for some limited period of time. And so they were very supportive and helpful. We raised a little bit of money, and I had a very specific strategy in mind of how to solve this problem. So it involved building libraries and really screening libraries in high throughput with mass spec, mm-hmm. where everyone else was doing, like, you know, they made one change, then they made the protein and they purified it, then they had some very complicated HPLC method of assessing the glycans. And I realized you need to do all that in a much more high throughput fashion. And that was one of the big sort of, I think, breakthroughs of understanding that you need high throughput analysis to really make this work. And so was able to put all that together. And within a year and a half, we had sort of caught up with everyone else that had been at this for almost a decade. And that's when people sort of developed faith that, hey, this guy said he's going to do this and looks like he's really making progress. And that's when we were able to raise more money. And
So this $500,000 that you get, you start sort of using that money to do more work at Dartmouth, though.
At Dartmouth, yes. But with a clear understanding that this is related to the company,
yeah.
And ultimately has to leave the labs of Dartmouth and find its own place. But at the beginning, they were kind enough to let me sort of, quote unquote, incubate it at the college.
Yeah, perfect. So how did you then actually move it outside the, and you stayed at Dartmouth, obviously, because you're still at Dartmouth, but did you... you know, bring some grad students with you to start the company? How did you actually, you know, build this thing that became a company that you could sell one day?
So again, part of the way to attract talent is you tell people a story. Like, you tell them, why is this important? This is why I'm doing it. And do you want to be part of this? And I ended up, you know, hiring a bunch of postdocs. And I think there were maybe a few grad students even that were involved, master students at least. Some Dartmouth undergrads were working on projects here or there. So it was a very vibrant, active time in my lab. Lots of people, like, totally overcrowded. So that's how we got the original team together. And at some point, we moved the company out and they became employees. Everything at the beginning ran through Dartmouth payroll and they were sort of postdocs, yeah. Right? So
then you're set up in an actual space. You're running a company. How many people were there when it was sold?
So I wasn't running it. So my partner, this former dean that I mentioned, his name is Charles Hutchinson. He was my sort of business partner. I was taking care of the science and he was taking care of
fundraising,
raising money. And he was a former dean. He knew a lot about, you know, organizational behavior and how to manage people and things like that, that I wasn't necessarily a master in at the time. So I learned a lot from him, and so he ran that, and I basically ran the science. And so we raised successive amounts of financing, started bringing in pharma partners that were interested in the work because they really felt that this may be the future. And so within a few years, we had probably 6-7 partnerships where we were showing people that we could make their protein that they thought they had to make in CHO in this yeast. And so
which was faster and cheaper?
It was faster, cheaper. And so at the beginning, the whole game was you make proteins in yeast is cheaper than making them in CHO cells.
Yeah.
What ended up emerging as a much more important aspect of the whole story is that at the same time that we were doing that work, the sort of the glycobiology community was appreciating that these sugars have profound impacts on pharmacokinetic behavior, pharmacodynamic behavior, half-life in general, on tissue-specific targeting with antibodies. Effector functions are highly glycosylation dependent. So all of a sudden, an industry that had one way of making all of these drugs and had no control over the composition of glycosylation, all of a sudden had a tool where you could take this yeast strain, it would make that structure. You take this, it makes a different structure. And now you could take a protein and make it with all its different glycoforms and then figure out which one is the most potent or which one has specific properties you're looking for. So it was a really up to that point, unknown capability, or nobody had that ability to do that at scale for sure. And so that's what became the, I think, the more interesting aspect.
And so these pharma partners would come in and say, we want you to build a protein that looks like this.
Exactly.
Can you do it? You
with this sugar structure.
Right, exactly. You'd say, we can do it. Here it is.
Yep.
And then they would, I don't know, they would then order it. You would fulfill an order from them, or no?
No, you would then license them the cell line, and then they would use that cell line for their manufacturing process.
Eventually, so you could have done that, you know, forever. You could have just kept bringing in pharma partners.
We could have, but life gets more complicated because there are always external factors that sort of start messing up your original vision. In our case, it was sort of that 2005, 2006 timeframe. This was a timeframe when nobody wanted to hear about platform companies. All these earlier genomics platform companies have gone bust,
right?
Or didn't pan out the way people thought. And so when you went out and raised money, people were like, we're not in platform, not interested. Platform, not interested. So it was a time where the venture community was not receptive to platforms at all. And they said, you need to develop your own drugs. And so this was a terrible decision that I, dumb and naive as I was at the time, I just didn't know any better, deferred to my board members and to my colleagues. And that's the path we went down for at least a year and a half. And it was a complete fool's errand. And
what was your target?
Our target was, believe it or not, it was a version of Rituxan that is afucosylated and therefore has a higher ADCC. This after, like, you know, you hire all these consultants. This is where sort of you have something really powerful and the business people are telling you, you need to do this, this, and this in order to raise money here. And again, I was too dumb and too naive to know any better. And so I had to go along with this. And so this went on for like a year and a half or two, at the end of which I was like, I'm done with this shit. I don't want anything to do with this anymore. You do whatever you want. And at that point, the board realized if I leave, that's probably really not a good thing for the company. And so they fired the CEO they hired to like execute the strategy. I got back in charge, and then within a few months, we did a big deal with Lilly, a big deal with Merck, and momentum really picked up quickly on sort of doing work for others and being a platform. And then, like, you know, half a year later, what happened is we met with our colleagues at Eli Lilly, and they said, like, we really want you to do all this work for us because we're very interested in this technology. And we said, love to, but we can't. We're fully at capacity. We just signed a deal with Merck. And then they called us the next day and said, we want to meet with you again. And so then we met with them and they said, look, we understand that you're at capacity, but we actually want to acquire the company. And so that then triggered a process where Merck was also a shareholder.
You were then, I mean, you legally had to turn around and tell Merck that
we had to, exactly.
Come in. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we had to because they were a shareholder, right? And so then, but then also, again, I was not directly involved in most of that negotiation. We hired Morgan Stanley, they ran the process for us. And at the end,
Merck won out.
Merck prevailed in that process and acquired the company. And so I'm
trying to remember, was that public at the time that Lilly had also put an offer in? I think we just heard that Merck was buying the company, and that's all I knew.
Yeah, I don't think it was public. I don't think we talked about it.
That's so fascinating. But this, to go back to this Rituxan, I'm going to say it's like a me better.
Exactly. It's a me better. It's a me better by people that are really good yeast geneticists, really good glycobiologists, really good protein analytical people. They're now all of a sudden going to be in the drug discovery business and developing a drug that is basically a bio better. I mean, it was preposterous. It was.
Yeah.
But anyway,
I mean, for you, that does not meet your criteria of a problem to solve. I mean, that was
definitely not
the platform. Absolutely. That was solving a problem. This is sort of applying that technology to make some money. And there's nothing wrong. I mean, look, biosimilars would really help the healthcare spend in this country. Absolutely. So, I mean, that is a problem in a way. But for you, I don't think I agree.
No.
I see why you'd be like, I don't want any part of this.
Yeah. And also the atmosphere was just. The science was more and more getting deprioritized. The really good people were like realizing that this isn't a place where they have a real, you know, intellectually curious home, and they wanted to leave. And so it just became increasingly difficult. But the good thing was, you know, the board realized that if I left, it would be bad. And they were willing to then basically go back to focusing on the platform, and it all worked out. And so, and again, what's so funny now is, like, you know, this was in 2006 that Merck acquired the company. It was, at the time, $400 million was real money. Right now, that's just like, you know, that's launch money. But back then, that was the largest private acquisition, largest all cash acquisition of a private company, which now is laughable when you look.
Right? Well, still, and so it was a huge, it was a 10x return. I think I read that someplace.
So the
investors made out as well. I mean, that's a win.
So what I learned from that is, I was not a glycobiologist, I was not a yeast geneticist, but I really had, I think, a sense of, this is an important problem, and I can put together a talented team to work on that problem and make real progress. And, like, really, I mean, again, there were others competing with us, but I think it's fair to say we are the ones who succeeded in cracking the scientific nut that needed to be cracked, and we were successful, and that ultimately got rewarded. And so, yeah, go ahead.
So that becomes the model for you then. If I can find a problem that I know I think I can crack and I think it has value, then the money will take care of itself.
Yes.
Okay. So then you turn to Adimab when you're done with Glycophy.
Well, that's another interesting story. So there, you know, at the time, again, that was 2006. Merck had just acquired Glycophy. A lot of people came to me at the time and said, like, I've got this great idea. I want you to work with me on this. And I looked at them, and some of them were interesting, and one of them was an antibody idea. And so I looked into that, and I thought, that's so interesting. I mean, the whole world of pharma is talking about how they're going to shift away from small molecules into biologics. And I'm like, there's only so many recombinant erythropoietins and insulins. And we've already shaken that tree pretty hard. So if you want to be in biologics, clearly antibodies are the answer, right? And so the only thing at the time, though, was that anybody sort of had this whole Kabili Genentech patent hanging over it. And so people in many of the phage technologies were covered by patents. And so people were saying, let's do alternative scaffolds. So I don't know if you remember, but this was the era 2006, 7, 8, 9 was every conference on antibody engineering you went to, someone had some new alternative scaffold that they were peddling. And we're like, nah, the most validated modality is human antibodies. And so we have to figure out how to get around all these patents and figure out a better way of doing it. So there was a legal challenge in terms of figuring out what the IP landscape is, but more importantly, come up with a solution where the integration of target biology just becomes easier and faster and more successful. And that's what the company ended up doing. And again, it was a pure hypothesis that if you build it, people will like it. And it turned out to be the case.
Another platform company.
Another platform company, yes.
So when you formed it, was there that same pressure on you? Well, okay, but you're going to take this platform and then you're going to find your own drugs off it and then and go down and make an asset and bring it to market.
I would say definitely not. Again, after the successful Glycophy exit, you just have a lot more understanding. You just know more and you know what investors you want to work with. And you also are just more experienced. So if someone had said that, I would say the answer is no. If you want to invest in a company like that, go find yourself something else. But that's not what we're doing here. So I think you have to be super transparent with what you're going to do and stick to that and be transparent to investors and set the expectations up front. And so I told them I'm going to build a platform company. If they then invested and decided we should do something different, it's their job to convince me that we should do something different, not the other way around.
And do you think that you had that power because you had that big exit? Now you sort of can say, you think so?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. I think, success gives you clout, right? Because you have returned multiples of the invested capital to the investors. And when you do that, they trust you more. They want to work with you more and they'll believe you more, right? I mean, let's not forget, I mean, this is an industry that is very interesting because in my view, there's an incredible amount of bullshit going on, and it's an industry that, you know, promises a lot, and very often delivers way, way, way less. And so it's reasonable for investors to be very skeptical when people say they're going to do X, Y, and Z. In 95% of the cases, people don't do X, Y, and Z. They barely do X.
Right. But why? So let me ask why. I agree, right? But I always feel like that's because it's harder than everybody thinks. And so the promises that you make cannot be done in 5 years. Sometimes it takes 10. Or what you think is possible, you start unwinding the biology and you realize that it isn't. And that's why it's I'm not going to say it underdelivers, because this industry has done amazing things. I mean, you would have to agree
absolutely
with that.
Yeah. I think we're talking about two different things. There is an inherent risk. This is a very risky industry.
Yeah.
Because there's scientific risk, there is legal risk, there's people risk. Then once you have a molecule, there's clinical risk. I mean, there's so much risk throughout the entire value chain, if you will, or creation chain. We all understand that. I think that what I'm sort of allergic to is the hyperbole and promising stuff that you know you don't like, the Elizabeth Holmes stories, right? Where
no one in the industry believed that. No one in the industry believed that. I mean, that's why her investors were not Atlas or 5AM. I mean, it was SoftBank.
True. But I think there is some level of that going on in our industry too. And you may disagree with that, but I don't.
I know. Just tell me. I mean,
I can. No, I'm not going
to name. I don't mean name names, but like, in what areas do we think that is happening? Gene therapy. I don't know, where there's sort of like immunotherapy. There's a lot of promises made with precision medicine that are not really showing up at the patient level yet.
Yeah. I mean, look, we all, to some extent, have to paint a picture of the future to raise money. The question is, with what level of integrity do you paint that picture, and with what, you know, what caveats do you insert into the promised land description that you're giving? And it's a super delicate conversation of what do you say and what is based on fact? What are you promising that may or may not occur in the future? And again, people have different tolerance on that spectrum of what they're willing to say and what they're willing to listen to, for that matter.
Huh. Okay. So Adimab is now, what, 12 years?
Yeah,
12 years old.
Yeah.
And
oh, no, 13. Yeah, almost 13.
And it's a platform company still.
Yep.
You have, I don't know how many partnerships you have, but many, many partners.
We have, at this point, over 75 partners.
Yeah, it's incredible. And I feel like this is like one of those, you know, when all the investors are saying, no, if we're going to invest in you, you need to have an asset, because the asset means you can sell it and then you get the entire revenue stream, whatever.
Yep.
You know, you've shown that is not the only way to make money in this industry, or to have a company that lasts a long time.
Yeah, so it's interesting, because again, when people talk about innovation, they always use the word, and they all associate different meanings with it. For me, innovation has many different levels, like corporate structure and how you actually think about a company. There's a lot of innovation there. Like normally, you know, venture investors, they want to invest, and then like, you know, typically within 7-8 years, they want to get their money back. You have to understand that, but you can build companies that go beyond that. You just have to figure out an innovative way of making them whole and allowing you to continue something, where you think it's better to not sell the company or not go public. And so there's opportunity for innovation in many different aspects of our industry, including corporate structure.
Yeah.
So in our case, we were loving what we were doing. People were coming to us in large numbers, and we had a real impact on the industry. I mean, with these 75 partners, we've worked on 340 plus drug discovery programs. Of those, currently 41 are in the clinic. And I can tell you, by the end of 2025, we're going to have over 100 drugs in the clinic, and one approved drug now, and there will be several approved drugs at that point, right? And so when you look at the sort of more financial world of biotech investing, you may be familiar with these royalty pharma funds, right? They buy up royalties.
Yeah.
We're doing the exact same thing. We're just not using capital to buy the royalties. We're using technology at the very beginning of the process to insert ourselves in this process where ideas around disease biology turn into molecules. We just do that really well. People like to work with us, but you have to be patient. It takes 10 years before that matures and actually becomes a royalty-bearing program. But that's what we've been doing now for 12 years, and I want to do it for another 10 years or however long.
Yeah.
Because that's a gift that keeps on giving. And now we're, you know, a highly profitable company. We can afford to to just wait and basically run this business that we've built.
So you're saying your technology is in one approved product now?
Yes.
But you've been living on R&D money, I would assume, for the past decade.
Well,
from these 75 partners that you've got.
It's essentially, yes. So they pay us to do the work, but then there are milestones if they go into the clinic and if they hit clinical milestones. Yeah. So it's a combination of funded discovery, of like research reimbursement, FTE reimbursement, And then milestones, and then at the end, of course, royalties.
Right. So, but the royalties are almost like icing.
They're icing, but they're such a huge piece of the future value. So we know essentially, the last time we raised money, well, let me go back to the innovation around corporate structure. So the company became profitable in 2013. Again, this doesn't happen often. Started in 07. Within 6 years, we had a profitable company.
It's been every year you've turned a profit since.
Every year since then, we've turned a profit. Okay. But in 2013, that was 6 years in, our venture investors were saying, yeah, you know, look, you know, been in this, love the company, love what we're seeing, but, you know, can we go public? You know, do we think someone's going to want to buy us? I'm like, what are you guys talking about? I'm totally not interested in that, right? And, but I'm a good partner. I understand your problem. Your problem is returning liquidity to your investors. So let's just focus on your problem. And don't tell me what to do with this company. I get your problem and let me solve your problem differently. So here we have a company in 2013, 2014 that was highly profitable, profitable in the foreseeable future, basically bringing in one royalty bearing program after the other and building this huge portfolio of royalty bearing programs, which aren't accretive now. They're not giving us a royalty now, but if you just look at the attrition funnel in antibody drug discovery, anyone can look at this and say, these are top companies with smart people that are taking these assets into the clinic. These guys are going to have drugs. And so there was a significant future value. Now, all of a sudden, you could look to investors that don't want to invest in highly risky biotech startups that promise you something that in most cases they don't deliver. Here's a company that was building an intrinsically valuable portfolio of programs. And all of a sudden, you're talking to insurance companies, you're talking to pension funds, and people that normally don't invest in biotech. And so what we simply did was say, okay, great, we'll sell you shares and then we'll take that money and we'll buy out the venture investors. And so what we did is over a period of time, we started, they used to own like 35% of the company, the venture investors. And we, at this point, they own like 18%. And we just, every year we buy them down a little bit and we bring in new investors that are much more long-term investors and care much more about the intrinsic growth of that portfolio than near-term liquidity. Well, so that's how we solved that problem.
So I love that. But how did you decide on what those share prices were going to be?
In the first process, we ran an auction, basically. We said, who's the highest bidder? And then we came to a price. And at that point, that was in 2018, that was at $1.1 billion.
For your net worth?
For the total market cap of the company.
Yeah, your market cap, right.
Yeah, and so we sold probably around 10% of the company. So we got $110 million and we just took that and bought out the existing investors. So like Google Ventures, we bought them out completely.
So do they have to, if you say, okay, we went out and did an auction and they valued the market cap of Adimab is going to be $1.1 billion, you said. And so that sets the share price at X. You then turn to Google Ventures and say, the share price is going to be X, we want to buy you out. And they have to agree to that or no?
No. What we said is, we're willing to buy your shares back.
At this price.
Tell us what you want to sell. In the case of Google, they said, look, we have a relatively small position. It's timing-wise, we would like to sell the entire position. And I'm like, everyone had 10% of the company was sold to the new investors. So everyone in the company was able to sell 10% of their shares, right?
The employees.
Everyone, the employees, everyone had the right to sell 10% of their shares.
It's like going public then.
It is like going public.
In that way, yeah.
But what I can tell you is I wasn't selling any shares. I was not interested in selling shares. So I was able to take my allocation of the shares I could have sold and said, okay, you know what, Google, you've been great partners. I'm going to allocate you all my liquidity. So if you want to sell them all at this price, I'm going to give you that. And so that's how that worked. And so...
But they could have said, no, we don't... These are only for the investors who said, look, it's been 10 years. We want to get
Exactly.
Okay.
I was scratching their itch because they were telling me, we want liquidity now. If you want liquidity, here it is. So that's what we did.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so it was... I think it's a... I've not heard anyone else do this in our industry. And so,
me neither.
So Brady, what happened then is we did that in 2014, 15, 16, 17, 18. The share price went up to over $4 billion. And every year now we've done one of those secondaries where we basically buy back shares, buy out the old investors and bring in new investors. And it's
And so now you've got long-term investors in the company.
Exactly.
No, none of that original VC. You're still private. And
some of them are still there, but they just have much smaller position.
Yeah, and they don't mind. Right? They want to be there.
Most of them want to be there. Yeah.
Yeah. That's fascinating.
No need to go public. No need to sell yourself. And we continue doing what we're doing, and everyone's happy. So
you're still at Adimab, you're still at Dartmouth, but you've got like a handful of other co-founded companies now that you're part of.
Yes.
Adagio. So I saw this happen and I thought, oh, okay. So this is somebody who's trying to prepare, someone who sees a problem as you often do and think there needs to be a fix. And that is we've had coronaviruses before. There are going to be more in the future and we need to be better prepared than we are right now.
Yes.
Is that the impetus for the company?
Completely. So let me tell you, like, again, the genesis story a little bit. So here we are in March. Cases are going up. It's clear that there's a direct path for companies that have good B-cell cloning technology to isolate antibodies that could do something useful here. At the same time, we're still very hopeful that vaccines are going to make a difference here. And so vaccines are typically a much more cost-effective and durable way of dealing with an infectious disease. So we first got data late March, early April from our collaborators at Albert Einstein that showed that patients in the Bronx that were anywhere between 35 and 55 days post diagnosis, in other words, convalescent patients, that 20% of them had no antibody titers, like no measurable titers against SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, telling us that the immune response to this virus for some reason is not very robust and is not very durable. And for us, that meant this is going to be a steep hill for vaccines, because if a live viral infection doesn't give you a robust immune response, vaccines are going to have a tough time. So that's when we realized antibodies may play a more important role here than we originally thought. The other thing is that the person that runs antibody sciences at Adimab is a woman named Laura Walker, who's been a prolific scientist in the area of B-cell immunology of viral infections, has extensively published on dengue, Zika, yellow fever, Ebola, you name it. I mean, she's made seminal contributions to that field and is a real thought leader. And Laura's view was, first of all, everyone's talking about SARS-CoV-2, when in reality, beta coronaviruses have been spilling over into the human population in a documented fashion now for decades. So we have several major outbreaks, SARS, MERS, now SARS-CoV-2, a global pandemic. We have two endemic viruses, HKU1, OC43. Mm-hmm. So these beta coronaviruses have been pretty active. And amongst those, the clade 1 beta coronavirus lineage B is the one that targets human ACE2 as an entry mechanism. And so that's SARS and SARS-CoV-2. And there are many viruses that are circulating in bats right now that use that same entry mechanism. And so her insight was, there is going to be a sequel to this movie. This is just round two. And if we solve this problem now, there's going to be another outbreak at some point in the future. We already had two ACE2 mediated outbreaks or pandemics with SARS and SARS-CoV-2. We need to find a solution to that human receptor, which is clearly vulnerable. And at the time, I mean, there's work that's been going on for decades of understanding of how these viruses recombine in nature, how they spill over to humans. This is all understood. So anyone who's like, who would have thought, just go and read the literature. It's all there. Okay. Yeah. I mean, you go read these papers from 2016 from Ralph Barrick's group, where he describes this virus WIV-1, and where he says, look, here's a virus that we isolated from bats. We can readily propagate this virus on human airway epithelial cells through an ACE2 mediated event. And by the way, this should give us, you know, sort of a warning sign that we should be prepared for this. Or he says this provides an opportunity for preparing for a future coronavirus outbreak in 2016.
Yeah.
Okay. Boom. Here we are 4 years later with a global pandemic.
Damning to read that now. It's so damning
to
read that.
It's rough. It's really rough. So it is our mindset was just playing this game of whack-a-mole. New pandemic, we work on it now and then it goes away. If we want to do something here, it has to be a holistic solution to the problem. And that means broad neutralization of the entire clade 1 beta coronaviruses, all the viruses that target ACE2 for human ACE2 for entry. That was the objective. And we said, if we can't get that, we're not interested, because Regeneron, they're awesome at doing B-cell cloning. Lilly and Opsela, they're doing a fine job. They know how to B-cell clone, but they're not approaching the problem the same way we are. And so this is where we just took a very different approach to the problem.
But first off, you know, how effective a vaccine is going to be. I'm kind of assuming that we're all going to have to get a booster every year. No, whatever one of the vaccines you get, you're probably going to need a booster every year. If what you just said actually holds up in the large population, the antibodies don't stick around that long, the titers are low, you know, so every year we get a booster until for sure is gone.
So I think if we get there, that actually would be pretty good. But tell me what the level of protection is. So if you get a shot once a year and you get 90%+ protection, we're done. We're back to normal. That's not what I expect. If you look at the data, and particularly if you look at data in elderly, I just don't think we're even close to that.
Like 50% protection. Not even.
Not even, I think.
Oof,
and again, for how long? So right now it looks like, I mean, these titers are waning quickly. So, you know, they peak after 3-4 weeks and then they come down like a bag of cement. And by the way, again, here's when you look at the literature. When you look at how other beta coronaviruses stimulate the immune system, it's all the same story. OC43, it's an endemic virus to humans. It's present over the entire globe, causes cold-like symptoms. You get infected, you're protected for about 40 weeks. And after that, within 50 weeks, your chance of reinfection is 50%. Okay, so if we're in that boat, so first of all, this whole notion of herd immunity, forget it. It doesn't exist because there is no lasting immunity. So anyway, so I hope you're right.
I mean, I'm only regurgitating what I've read, all right? I mean, you're the person that I want to ask these questions to. So I hope I'm right too, but I don't have any idea.
It's just with the plastic.
I want to ask one more final thing. Yeah. And you probably know what I'm going to ask about. So a couple years ago, a year ago, Adamant put out a paper and saying that Ram Sasaskaran's paper on influenza antibody and a Zika antibody had been previously published in other journals. You said that they could not be reproduced. He's an MIT researcher. There'd been a company formed around his research, and it was a big deal, right? Go ahead.
I can't judge whether it's a big deal. What I know is...
Well, it became a big deal. It became a big deal in the media, and it was this researcher is accusing another researcher, and who knows what's right. Your paper was, a lot of people were saying this, your paper was, looked good, right? Like it seemed to lay it out exactly as the problem was. He denied the whole thing. I actually don't know what happened. I assume that MIT did an investigation, but I don't know what the results were.
Yeah.
Do you? Or is it ongoing?
I don't know anything really. I know a few things. I know MIT tried very hard, not just he himself, but as an institution, tried to pressure the publisher not to publish the work, which I find outrageous. This is an institution that is paid by the public to get information out there. We were not accusing it, by the way, of anything. All we said is, here's our findings. This guy said he did X, Y, and Z.
It looks very similar to what we see in this paper and this paper.
He doesn't even disclose the sequence. That's the first problem with the whole publication industry. They always want sensationalist claims, but they don't want to enforce their own editorial policies. So that's the first thing that rubs me the wrong way. No sequences. So here's someone who says, I have this great gizmo that I invented, but I'm not telling you actually what it is. I'm just telling you it can do these things. I mean, I just think it violates fundamental principles of scientific communication, which is tell me what you did. Do it in a way where it's reproducible and other people can check it. And he did none of those things. And so he made these extraordinary claims of how he did all this on a computer.
Yeah.
And so then our head of computational biology, who's just an incredibly good sleuth. Well, I should say this also. Within AdaMap and my co-founder, Dane, whenever we heard his name, everyone thought he's full of shit. And it's not true.
Previously.
Because we had worked in this area for many years too, and we understood how incredibly difficult it is. And in particular, you can get binders, but then they end up not being specific. It is a very hard problem. We're nowhere close to solving that problem. So when all of a sudden someone comes out of the woodwork, does not describe the method, does not describe the composition of the thing that was actually supposedly created from this algorithm, you get a little bit skeptical.
That raised a flag for you.
that raised the flag for us, and we all thought it's, but we, there was nothing actionable. I mean, look, people say a lot of things and they claim a lot of things. It's not our problem, really, right? If someone exaggerates their competence, it happens every day. So that's not something we find actionable. But what happened is that our head of computational biology, Max Vasquez, ended up figuring out the actual sequence. So he basically said, okay, this is what's said in the paper. Let's see whether there are any patents associated with that. Sure enough, there were patents. And then from the patents, you could sort of figure out what the corresponding sequence was. And then he took that sequence. And then he found, well, that sequence looked awfully like an antibody that was described 3 years before. So that was in the first case. That was in the, I think the Zika case was the first case. And then yeah. Well, let's look at another case. So he looked at the second case, which was this influenza antibody. And here again, same story. No disclosure of sequence. These extraordinary claims of how this was all done on a computer. And again, he was able to trace it back to the patents. And in the patents, again, we take that sequence and we find that that sequence was published before by another group. So what's the chance of this guy having this computer that keeps on spitting out sequences that were already described by other people in the past? That chance is pretty slim. And again, I'm not judging the likelihood. I'm just saying, I think it's slim. You may think it's very likely. So our obligation at that point was to say, look, these things that this guy is describing, that, by the way, he isn't willing to disclose, we're telling you what they are, and we are telling you they look like this. That's what we did. And then there were other little things in there that were just so incriminating. So in one of the sequences, the original paper had a cloning artifact of two amino acids that were in the antibody sequence. This is not a sequence that is normally associated with an antibody. But for some reason, when his computer is trying to find sequences that bind to this target, they include that artifact. I mean, at that point, we knew there's no way that this wasn't the template for this. And so we felt, again, we didn't accuse anyone. We just said, here are the facts as we see them. And that paper was downloaded 14,000 times in one week in MABS, which is not a, you know, a journal that I think typically
traffic
sees.
Yeah.
Yes. So anyway,
you have to understand, de facto, that was an accusation. Even if the paper, I mean, when that came out, everyone's like, okay, let's look over there and let's look at RAM. And they did. So it was, it functioned as an accusation, even though there's nothing in the paper that really accused him of everything. So the question that I want to ask is, if we look at your history, if we look at Metabolics, and you left there and you said, with the claims they're making, I do not agree with. In fact, I think they're false. I'm going to write a paper on it. And then this right here we're talking about with Ram's paper. My question is, when you come across those things, there's several ways you could deal with it. You could throw up your hands and quit. You could go to the press and say, hey, by the way, I'm going to be a whistleblower and say something's going on. But what you do is you turn around and attack it with science and publish it as a scientist.
Yep.
And to me, it feels like when you come across these things, especially if money's is involved, in his case, he had a company formed around this technology, Vistara.
He'd already sold the company. So he already cashed his check.
Yeah. But venture capital money had gone into that problem, into that technology. Yep. And Metabolics was, you know, a functioning company that had venture capital in it too.
Yep.
But it seems to me that you are like morally offended when you come across those things, that this is not the way science should be done. And it makes you furious. Am I accurate in reading it that way?
You're 100% accurate. I think we are, being a scientist, in particular, being a scientist that is paid by the public, in my view, you're paid to find the truth. It's a very noble exercise. And if you corrupt that, or it's a very noble profession, I should say.
Yeah.
And if you corrupt that profession solely for the purpose of self-enrichment, it offends me deeply.
Yeah.
And yes, and so when I see it, I have no fear of calling it out because I think I have,
a moral duty.
And a moral duty on the one hand, and I'm in a fortunate position where I'm not afraid of it. I don't mind. And again, I have to say, like in the MIT case, what I loved about the people that I work with, my co-founder Dane, Max Vasquez, Eric Crowland, our CSO at Adamap, Laura Walker, who is very close to this whole body of work, every one of them said, that's the right thing to do. We have an obligation to the public to publish this. And our business development group said, are you guys fucking crazy? People are going to be mad at us, this and that. I said, look, at the end of the day, we're a scientific organization. We're an organization of integrity. And if we find something like this, we have an obligation. And so it was so ironic that The business development group wanted us not to do it. And later on, we were accused that we somehow did this for financial gain, which is absolute nonsense. I mean, there was no gain for us at all.
Yeah. But the, I mean, you could have gone to the journals that published those two papers of his and said, hey, we think that there's something factually wrong and let the journal handle it.
We did. And but guess what the journals did?
What?
Oh, we don't want to hear about it. We'll launch an investigation. They're still there. There's no retraction. There's nothing.
Oh, you tried that first before you published.
We told them in advance, telling them that this would come out so that they were prepared and that they could sort of react to a potential media inquiry.
They don't care.
The sad thing is they don't care. I tell you, they don't care.
Yeah. I mean, the criticism that I saw coming your way was that this looked like a broadside, like a blind attack, and that you could have gone to the journals and people felt like maybe you could have done it another way.
I think that's fair. Yes, it could have done in many other ways. This is used to be like things like that were handled between, men in brown couches slurping whiskey or something, right? You know, but that's fine. That's a world that I don't want to be part of. I think.
This is why, I mean, I think it is admirable that when you see something that offends your morality as a scientist, you blow it up.
I make it public. Whether it then blows up is another question. But I think in this case, the public was interested in this. This was not a nothing burger. I mean, again, 14,000 people in a week. That's a fair amount of traffic for a scientific publication.
Yeah,
right.
Totally agreed. Yeah, it is one of the reasons. Look, this is why I like talking to you. I know that when I talk to you, you are going to shoot me straight. You're going to tell me what's on your mind, and you're not going to be scared about it. That's refreshing in this industry for sure.
Oh, thank you.
And I find it admirable. But as I watch this thing unfold, I was like, yeah, he really gets angry about these things that where science is being tread upon.
Yes, I find it's a very noble profession that the public pays for. That's when you abuse that trust just so you want, because you want to enrich yourself. I'm offended by that. Yeah, I really find that offensive.
Yeah.
And angry. I don't think I got angry. I just think, look, we have the fact. Let's put the facts out. Let's see where they fall. And if I were to like judge the response we got, yes, there were some people angry that wanted to, his buddies. But the vast majority of people that reached out to us were like, we really admire that you guys did this. And we feel there was nothing in it for you other than standing up for the integrity of science. That was the overwhelming response.
Yeah. And again, I have no idea if it was accurate or not, but I don't know. I was waiting to see what would happen. And I don't know that I've ever saw anything.
Well, this is where my huge, again, I told you before, MIT had a life-changing effect on me. And I always viewed it as sort of the Taj Mahal of truth-seeking and this incredible institution. And then how I saw them behave in this situation, I just was really turned off. That was not, and again, institutions like that can survive a situation like this easily. We investigated, this is what we found, end of story. But I think their desire was, let's sweep this under the rug and move on.
That reminds me, I want to ask you something that has nothing to do with this podcast. So just going to say thank you for doing this.
Yeah, it was fun. I enjoyed it.
Totally enjoyed it. And I'm going to pause this. Hold on.
All right, that is it. There it is, your First Rounders podcast with Tilman Gerngross. Thank you, Tilman, for the conversation. I always enjoy it. I thought that was really interesting, the way they provided liquidity for earlier investors of Adimab without ever going public. If you have questions or comments on this show or anything that Nature Biotech does, you can find us on Twitter. Our handle is @NatureBiotech. I'll put some information up into our community page relevant to this show. I'll get the paper on entrepreneurship that Tilman wrote for us years ago and put that there. And I'll also pull some back coverage about the Adimab paper and the MIT researcher at RAM, Sassy-Zakarin. That'll be in our community page. You can find it there. Thank you to the Midwest Quiet for use of your music in this podcast. You're listening to this on November 1st. If you're an American citizen, vote if you haven't already done so. Vote. That is all I have to say for now. I will talk to you on the next one. Thank you and goodbye.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics, all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.